Welcome to the Culture and Sports Podcast, where we have discussions about how leadership and organizational culture impact organizational success, team and athlete performance, and the short and long-term mental, physical, and emotional health of athletes. The Culture and Sports Podcast is brought to you by Culture and Sports. Culture and Sports helps sports organizations, teams, coaches, support and front office staff, and athletes understand the importance of leadership and organizational culture and its direct impact to success.
Please join Robert Boland and Dr. Jeremy Piasecki in this season of the Culture and Sports Podcast.
Hi, everybody. I'm Bob Boland. I'm proud to welcome everybody back to the Culture and Sports Podcast, Season 5, The Future of College Athletics. We have a colleague that I was fortunate enough to work with early in my career, and somebody who I've remained friendly with and really anxious to work with again in this next phase of my career. I don't know anybody whose interests and passions and expertise align better with the mission of culture and sports than does Dr. Janine Dannenbaugh. Janine's lived an incredible life, both working with trauma patients and helping to do amazing things in regard to reducing sexual assault and its impact. She's been an athletic counselor, in performance counselor. She's back doing that in this stage of her career. But I don't know anybody who's better at this and more aligns with us, and I'm thrilled to welcome her today. Janine, thrilled to have you here. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself that we've left out?
Thank you so much, Bob. Yes, I'm happy to do that. And Bob and I met at the University of Tennessee. And really, for me, that's where everything started, where I basically cut my teeth working in the women's athletics department there at Tennessee as a graduate student. And really, from that point, went on to not only work with student athletes, but then expanded my background to work in the area of psychological trauma in the community. So I worked as the director of trauma services at a community mental health center for 23 years. And in addition, being the executive director of Moving to End Sexual Assault, which is a sexual violence resource center out here in Boulder, Colorado. And then, as Bob mentioned, more recently, after doing that for 23 years, I was ready to kind of step away, do something different. And I came full circle back to college athletics, where I'm the director of psychological health and performance at the University of Colorado, Boulder. So very, very interesting path. But I think, as Bob mentioned, I what has remained is a real interest and passion in learning everything I can about helping people heal from adverse events and treating trauma and stress and anxiety in general. And we have, unfortunately, no shortage of that currently in our world and in athletics.
Janine, we didn't talk about the fact that you were a former collegiate athlete, and that there's and that the that from high school to college and on into your life, you sports and athletic performance, whether it's basketball or yoga, plays a role in that, and you've even made some important inroads in infusing athletic activity in trauma reduction.
100%. And Bob, you think too much of me. I was not a varsity collegiate athlete. I was a late bloomer. But I played, you know, certainly club sports through college, but I did play in high school. But yeah, I throughout my career, really, I discovered yoga as my own like healing modality and passion. And then I was able to weave that into kind of the mental health space and teach what we call trauma-informed yoga. And just a huge, huge believer in movement in general as being a healing vehicle for trauma and stress.
You were a part of our summit recently, and a very valued part of it, talking about the pressures that athletes and their parents in particular, kind of the family unit of athletics, and a complicated family unit face here and there in the space, And that it's a rapidly changing space. It's a professionalizing one. It's a place where people have their focal connection, whether fathers and daughters through sport, mothers and children through sport, and then through our developmental sports system, parents are a part of that journey, having in many cases paid, driven, or been a part of that process from the beginning. Wanted to get your sense, since you're on the front lines of it. Can you describe some of the pressures that an athlete in college faces right now that maybe they didn't years ago, or maybe they're ones that are increasing because of the changing times?
Yes, absolutely. So I think some of the pressure is enduring, right? I don't think it has changed in terms of just keeping up with the demand, the schedule demands of a Division I, or not even Division I, a collegiate athlete and then academic demands. But what I have really observed is in this new era where there is perhaps a demand characteristic for more, you know, self-promotion and branding through different spaces, social media space, websites, YouTube, everything to kind of talk about that part of their academic collegiate experience, then promote it, to film it, to, you know, interface with it in the various platforms. It's, while for some it can be enjoyable and fun and exciting, it does add another element of pressure because it's something to keep up with, to do, to stay on top of, a pressure to have it be or look a certain way. And I really have noticed that that can add to just the normal pieces of practice and class and rehabbing an injury. That's layered on top of this now. So super challenging.
That's up.
Janine, you brought up a new era. Can you expound a little more on that? Because, you know, obviously on the non-psychological, emotional side, you know, we see, okay, there's NIL and there's athletes as employees and just all these new things that are happening, right? But on your side, to include trauma, what are you seeing and why do you classify it as a new era?
I think because it is like it's something that athletes never had to worry about. Like it things were just the way they were in the tracks, so to speak. Like, I'm going to come, I'm going to do my sport, I'm going to do school. And now it's like, let me learn about who are potential sponsor partners for myself, who are potential ways I can become visible. And Jeremy, I think the thing about what also makes it a new era is with that visibility, right? And with that partnership, could potentially, of course, not always, become more avenues for exploitation or deception or disappointments, right? So that's a whole bucket. That's a whole new bucket of kind of some psychological stressors there that were never there before. While it can be very exciting, there's also kind of an underside to that. So that's why I call it a new era.
I wanted to jump in right on that one because you're a native Ohioan, and there's the famous sort of phrase of Woody Hayes saying, when you threw the football, three things can happen and two of them are bad. We're laying out a lot of things that can happen when one plays sports, and recognizing that one playing sports at a high level should be a joyous thing, a great door opening opportunity that either ends when it ends, but now it has a lot of other burdens. As you point out, it has the burden of your image, your brand, your opportunity to earn money, your potential for disappointment, and the fact that in some cases we're putting a lot of pressure on young people at an even earlier age in a professionalized model. Any thoughts on the development and any thoughts on safeguards and conversations that you would have in the hypothetical with athletes who are going through that?
Oh, man. Well, you know, I guess when you were talking, Bob, one thing that came to mind, it's like, yeah, okay, we have to think about as athletes navigate this, like who are their support systems as they navigate this, right? Who are helping to support or advise, right? And we could say, okay, I would say have good support systems, and are there some people in the support system that might have other motives, like, or add to the pressure of, okay, maybe you need to do X, Y, or Z so you can then support the family, or there's an implicit pressure to support the family, or, so I think the conversations to have are, as athletes are doing this, is like, who are their supports? Are their supports really truly helping, or are the supports maybe driving up the stress factor for them? And are athletes, do they have the skills developed to be able to set good and healthy and appropriate boundaries with support system when needed? And just developmentally, when we're looking at college age students, 18 to 24-ish, I think this is a time when they are learning about how to, like, what is a healthy boundary? What are healthy relationships in this way? And now, in this new era, having to set boundaries as it relates to, like, finances and brand and pressure, like, that's a whole different reason to have to set a boundary. So it's rough, man. They're potentially rough for student athletes to navigate that. That would be enough rough for me to navigate that as a person in my 50s, right? And who considers herself to be fairly assertive and comfortable saying no and comfortable kind of self-directing, right? That's still hard for me. And then you get someone in a different developmental age, I think it's rough, potentially.
Now, when athletes are exploring this, you were just saying, well, you're assertive and you could say no. A lot of this is new for, athletes, not only being athletes outside of youth sports and high school sports. Now they're exploring, collegiate sports. Now they're exploring self-promotion. Now they're exploring also being an adult, right? Like they're exploring a lot of different things. But there's always an opportunity for people who are outside of the circle, the support circle, to come in, or there's already people inside the support circle, both of which may not be aiming for the best interest of that athlete. For you to say no, for me to say no, for Bob to say no, like it's pretty easy. But if you have a family member or someone who's incredibly coach or incredibly close, or a coach or a former coach who are all trying to be in your support circle, wouldn't it? I would have to imagine, if I reflect back to my age, or when I was that age back then, and I have to imagine it'd be difficult to say no to some people. Can you explore that a little bit more?
Yeah, say no, or to even discern who to listen to, right?
Exactly.
Like, so, right? I mean, Bob, I'll keep going. I'll keep riffing here off of your football metaphor. I mean, there's a reason that the quarterback, right, has one voice in his or her ear. Like, right, you don't want, like, every coordinator talking through that's gonna confuse the play call and the execution, right, of the play. And I think that's applicable here because there can often be different voices in the air with different kind of agendas. So I think it really, again, it comes to the athlete's ability to kind of set boundaries, to have discernment, and to also know what they want, like really to get in touch with what they want, not what other people say they should want or should do. And again, that's developmentally challenging. I mean, think back. I'll think back at 20, and I had vague ideas of what I wanted, but I could also be pretty influenced at that point in time by my peer group, right, by family members. So I think it's hard to find that North Star for athletes sometimes where they have that clear vision of where they're going.
Janine, you hit on it, I think, a brilliant place, and it's something I'm wrestling with in my practice right now. I've received a call from an athlete who received, whose family ultimately received a deal from Nili, the group that essentially is almost predatory in the sense that they're offering upfront money in exchange for 7 years of your future NIL earnings.
Ooh.
So this is a case where the athlete got about $150,000 upfront on what would be $500,000 he'll have to either pay back monthly or pay back over in the 7 year period. So it's 150 for 500. So essentially, maybe a little bit better than the worst organized crime interest rate or VIG when we see it. But for him and for the family that were involved in it, this was something that they felt that was the right thing to do in the moment. It seems like there's always somebody to take something from an athlete in these moments. For every great athletic achievement, there's always somebody who either wants to be a part of it or take it from you. Is there something that you can say to an athlete or a young athlete about how to hear those voices? You're somebody who is a trusted advisor, is somebody who listens to best interests and asks questions. How could you talk somebody into that identification process and help them skill up in that area?
Yeah. So I would say, like, really having people reflect on when they've had to make other choices in their lives, right? Even though, relatively speaking, I mean, it's not that high stakes, but it's still a significant choice, like maybe what university to attend, what kind of what to major in. Okay, so to kind of look back on other decision points they had to make and help them start to discern who was guiding me to self-explore what I wanted versus telling me what to do. Right? And I mean, I'd like to think that in the field of counseling, that's what we do anyway. It's like I help Jeremy, Bob, really get in touch with what your desires and heart is versus me telling you what to do. And so I would probably guide that exploration of like who has really helped you get clear on your needs and wants, and then use that same kind of approach to this, even though the stakes are higher, it's really the same principles involved, you know?
And to some degree, has the current NIL monetization of college sort of made it harder to find out who those people are? Because people are offering us good stuff. And in an environment like that, who do we trust most, and how do we filter those voices? And I think it is a great journey of discovery in that way. I wanted to ask you a little bit about, and we've had a lot of debate back and forth about the role of NIL and how it affects women's athletics.
Yes.
And it's a unique environment there too. There have been women who have done exceptionally well in this space. There are women who I think are the true winners in NIL, telling a great story. And I think women's professional sports has won as a result of this too, given the valuations that we're seeing for women's soccer and women's ice hockey in the professional leagues, and just the growth of the WNBA again, that new spur of momentum. But in a great moment, are there some downsides and some challenges that women athletes face in particular in this space?
So I'm very excited to kind of talk about this because and these thoughts aren't fully formed, but I think what I wonder about is how does the like what is the bias in this process of who is promoted? And for instance, are we looking at somebody who embodies a certain body type? In terms of their weight or their appearance, or that are more heteronormative, right? Or who, whatever, their race, who's being lifted up in this space versus who might feel like this space isn't for me. And that concerns me on a lot of levels. Excuse me. One, it then concerns me that then the images that we see in female athletes, right? Again, what about someone who doesn't identify with the group that's particularly seen as attractive and marketable? And then what messages do other athletes internalize about that? And then I wonder about that. I worry about that. And I don't know if we know the outcome of this ship. Like we have enough data, but I'd be curious your thoughts about that. Because
I wanted to ask you about two specific examples, and one I think exceptionally positive, who grabbed onto it with an angry run. I'm lucky enough to represent USA Rugby in a variety of ways, and I haven't met her, but my God, Ilona Marr was this absolute breakout at the Olympics, and for body positivity, for strength, for caring. She's also a registered nurse, so after she breaks your nose, she can put it back together. And how well she's done in terms of turning that into a public image, but she'd already done a pretty good job of it before. So I think she's a unique messenger who I think is at least exploring this in a really organic and personal and authentic way. I feel a little bit sorrier, not because of for her, because she's a magnificent player. But I feel a little sorry for Caitlin Clark, whose image has been taken by people who want to project other things onto her in odd ways. And it's been great business for the league, but is it great business for sport? Is it great business for the people involved? So I kind of want your thoughts on that.
Oh man, I mean, what I really hear in that as you talk is like exposure, and in the exposure there can be positives, and then there can be a ways where, oh boy, look what's being done to me out there in that space, or things projected on me. And I do think that that has the potential for some mental health implications. I really do. Like just some worry, some anxiety, some depression, anger, like all those pieces when you feel like you're not in control of how you're portrayed or what's projected onto you in that exposed space. I would really love to talk to some of those athletes to kind of understand the impact, because then I think we could learn more about how to navigate this. Because Bob, I mean, let's rewind back when we were at the University of Tennessee. We worked with some incredible student athletes at that time who were not, obviously, like it was not the era for this kind of exposure in that way. So my thought is those athletes had a little more control over like how they were seen, how they presented themselves. They just didn't have to deal with this. So, yeah.
That's a fascinating
Jeanine, oh,
question.
go
Go
ahead.
ahead, Jeremy.
No, you led me right into the question I was actually going to ask you, Jeanine. So, mental health and we'll just call it safety across the board, and it can even be physical safety here. So, before athletes with their support structure or ecosystem were focused on, competing, practicing, go to class, doing all these different things in collegiate sports, right? But now there's this whole new aspect. And so before, of course, there were people in the support structure that were trying to do the best for you as an athlete. Maybe there were a couple who were trying to take advantage because of their own agendas, not the athlete's agenda, but their own agendas. Now there's this whole new world. And, not only is there are there more safety issues, right? Like, and I'm sure you could talk about that for days, but also, do you think the adverse impact and the damage that could be created by the support system could actually be like incredibly worse now than it, say, it was even 2 years ago? Just if, the athlete is taken advantage of by someone who might be especially close to them?
I mean, 100%, 100%, and it sets it up for that, right? And it sets up not only for someone that's close to the athlete, but like when there's visibility, which is great. I mean, women, and Bob, women for a long time have wanted visibility. It's like, we actually have female sports in college too, right? We have wanted that visibility. But sometimes with the visibility and the promotion, okay, the chance of being violated in some way goes up. And Jeremy, like you were saying, not only with your with people you know, but people you don't know. I think about things like this isn't a topic that is very good to talk about, but you think about the very real dangers of stalking. And you think that when someone puts their life out in this, you know, on different platforms, the ability to like Google and get a zillion results and find out a zillion pieces of information about that person. And then for female athletes in particular, although it does happen to men too, but female in particular, the risk, I think, of being stalked or violated in some way with sexual harassment or stalking or sexual, in some cases, sexual assault, in my mind, goes up with that visibility. So I would like us to see us talk about that and then to put things in place. So Bob, like for instance, like with attorneys, with coaches, with whoever, it's great when you get an athlete and you lift them up, but are we also talking about a safety plan for them? Right? Are we also talking about how are you taking care of yourself? In the internet space, or you know, in your day-to-day space, like where you live. You know, so we're thinking that too.
It's way more complicated than we make it, even from a Title IX perspective or a sexual assault prevention perspective on campuses. You two are both experts, and I've had the pleasure of working with each of you in some context. Jeremy on the organizational idea of toxic culture recovery. Jeanine, I think much more so on the psychology and individual recovery aspects and safety aspects. But one of the things I wanted to get your impression on, Janine, and Jeremy, please feel free to jump in on this because it's sort of in your bailiwick too. One of the things I saw as an athletic integrity officer is I saw a lot of cultures that ran aground, whether it was a team that had become bad, whether a coach had become toxic, whether there had been an event that caused the separation of a coach or a need to investigate a program. And it was always very hard afterwards, because we thought we made a change and we made things better. And I remember once saying a general counsel at the university made a comment, well, isn't it just better that the people have changed? And I'm like, no, you can't do that anymore. You actually have to take remedial action and corrective action with the people who are still there, who remember and endure. How much time and attention, not necessarily in college sports, but everywhere, does it take to correct a situation that has become toxic for many? What's
Oh,
the
Bob.
intentionality of that?
Bob, I mean, I'm echoing what Janine was just thinking is we could talk about this for days and there's so many different aspects. I mean, outside of an organization, and this is really more toward like down Janine's road here, but like it could be forever that people who were adversely impacted at the time, it could last forever for that person who was adversely impacted. So, you know, we could talk about that for days. Now on the organizational side, if the behavior and the culture and the climate and the abuse was normalized, that could also last an incredibly long time, if not forever, with the people who remain. Because what they think is okay, like the rest of us would say that's not okay, but they were so conditioned to it, like it's not just, okay, the toxic situation's gone, the abuser is gone, let's now move on and things are going to be fine and great because the people are gone and now we're afresh. Like, even people who were adversely impacted, even not adversely impacted, that trauma still carries with them.
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. I don't have much more to offer. Jeremy spoke to it so well. I mean, the word that comes to mind is like legacy. Like it leaves a legacy of toxicity, right? And like an abuse. You know, I come to think of mine like the situation at Penn State University, right? Bob, I know you worked closely in that situation. You know, it was a long, long time, much after there had been turnover in the coaching realm, right? But like I think to Jeremy's point that there still were probably different administrators or people who lingered that have had some association there. And it takes so long to feel like a legacy has changed. And I think it does change. I think it does. And I believe it can. But I think it has to be a little bit more intentional than just firing a coach. Or, you know,
it absolutely right. has to be. I would yeah. jump in on that one only in the sense that, you know, the two things that I would say that obviously the creation of the position I ultimately had, I think, was one of the remedial measures that was an important one. The other important piece was that Penn State did try to address this situation with transparency, that they made all their report public. They made nothing subject to privilege. And they've tried to sort it out. Now, they're still dealing with some issues about what's the status of Joe Paterno, a beloved head coach, and his legacy in that piece. That's going to be another 10 years for them to write because it's a complicated one, and history can't be written in one generation. But I do think that they were able to, through their transparency and calling a full stop and their willingness to fully investigate, some of which was forced, but some of which I think was a positive of the culture and the 300 suggestions that form the free report, which is controversial, but still, I think, very important. It made my job much easier for the first half of it. I think it got a little harder as we got farther out from the people who had active memory of that to people who had no memory, who wanted to just operate like everybody else. So despite the fact that we had this risk factor, this past risk, to deal with. So it is complicated, but I do think one of the most important attributes from my standpoint on this, and this is the value of candor and transparency. And that was the one thing I think Penn State did particularly well, in addition to setting up some safeguard structures to do it. So I would probably say to you, having been in the job, we came back a lot faster than people expected. I thought they might wander in the wilderness forever. And by the time I came into it, they were coming off probation. They had their NCAA supervision ended early. So there were a lot of good things. Now, still, the cultures in big athletic departments are complicated things. Sport cultures are complicated, and you don't always get it right. So there's always that issue. But how do you value some of these things? Transparency. What are formalized steps at crisis recovery? If you were saying, look, I have a problem, I need to address it. What would the formalized steps from your standpoint be?
Well, I love your words, candor and transparency, right? I'm going to go in a really weird direction here. Just bear with me. But I, unfortunately, in my career, have had the just horrible honor of participating in like recovery in mass disasters. Okay. Some of that have occurred here in Colorado, mass shooting events. That just bring just such a heavy cloud over the community, over individuals. And I think what has, where I have seen healing and recovery take place is candor and transparency and to bring the darkness into the light and to say, you know, to not kind of shut it down, but actually to bring it out and say, okay, here, this is what happened here. Let's actually talk about what happened here. Let's discuss what's happened here. And unfortunately, in our systems, I think when adversity hits, when crisis hits, we tend to go underground in those systems. And I think if we could learn anything as we navigate the time in college athletics now is to let's keep it all on the table. And I right. think, right. Let's yeah. keep it on ground.
Yeah. You know, another thing that I wanted to bring up earlier, and it just keeps on echoing in my brain while both of you are talking about this, is it's not only the abuse or, you know, the
negative situation that athletes or coaches or support staff or anyone else in the ecosystem within a college athletics program. But it's also the follow-on actions, whether it's a cover-up or a direct cutoff of the situation, or we're going to address it right now and be transparent, or we're gonna, continue to push the people that were already abused or adversely impacted, we're gonna continue to push them down instead of addressing the situation. I think a lot of that has to deal with the legacy as well that Janine was talking about is, Bob, I think you walked into a decent situation at Penn State when you became the athletic integrity officer, because I think they addressed some of those things, that it wasn't only what happened, but it was the cover up, and it was also how they treated, athletes and coaches and people that were identifying that this happened originally. And so I think that with how they addressed it was a lot better than most organizations would have in the past. But I caveat that with saying that it was also covered up for a very long time, what happened. And so for those that were adversely impacted, it probably will stick with them, for a long time, if not forever, just because it took so long for it to be addressed itself.
I have a tendency, I think, as humans, to kick the milk under the refrigerator. And I kind of have that conversation as a guy who may at some point have drunk milk out of a carton in front of the refrigerator, that you spill some and you don't wipe it up. You just kind of kick it under. And in our culture, we leave a lot of that at the bottom of the refrigerator. At some point, whatever that does, it sort of grows, congeals, changes state, and ultimately will throw the refrigerator on top of you when you come back at some point. So it's important to have the cleanup in the moment when it's a much smaller issue. It's the drip milk. To that question, Janine, I want to talk to you about how a coach today navigates the changing dynamic in relation to their athlete. And I know you are close friends with a number of coaches. You've advised them going back through the whole phase of your career. And I always sort of think about the example of the great Pat Summitt, that she would have figured out a way to deal with anybody, anytime, anywhere, even if she might have said, "I don't like it a lot," in private, because she was that emotionally intelligent to handle things. And you may have seen her in the moments when she was handling it less well sometimes. But I wonder how a great coach like a Pat Summitt would have naturally evolved to the modern times. But also, how can a coach who's not so gifted, maybe somebody who's struggling, what advice would you give them to navigating the psychology of the 18 to 22 year old athlete today?
Boy, great question. Three things come to mind. Well, and let's continue to channel Pat, at least on two of them. I think, Pat was adept at building in structure into her program. Like, it was pretty structured. And I think when there is some chaos or unpredictability, structure helps contain. Structure helps decrease anxiety. So my suggestion for coach would be we structure practice, we structure this, maybe we structure how they're going to navigate these changes with NIL. Like, there's some, and I don't know exactly what that looks like in a granular level, but at a macro level, it's like structuring it out somehow so there's less bleed. The other thing, again, channeling Pat, that she was, Pat was not afraid to educate herself and educate her players. So to strive for education, to be informed, to understand every element of this so that coaches can be a source of, wisdom or support to the athletes. But we got to first educate ourselves to know what we're dealing with. And then, what was my third one? Support, structure, and I can't remember the third. It'll hit me in a minute. But I know, I got it. I don't know if you're having these discussions too, but to not judge. I know it's very easy for me as, again, 50-year-old something, psychologist, about things that take athletes' attention or what they're interested in or what versus what I think they should be interested in, right? And it's so easy to enter in that place of judgment, to judge things. And, you know, usually, most of the time, judgment is not helpful when it comes. Then I can maybe have the judgment, aware I'm judging, but not actually verbalize on those judgments. And so for coaches to be like, this is a big deal for a lot of athletes right now, for a lot of reasons and a lot of good reasons, and to kind of take a backseat in the judgment category, I think, for coaches.
That sounds like
and also to be empathetic as well, right? Like, you know, coaches need to realize that, you know, I'm assuming that the coach played the sport or just played sports in general, that it wasn't as, it's not as easy now as it was back then. You know, there were less stressors, there were less detractors, there were so many less things that athletes need to deal with now. And so as a coach, if I were to reflect back to my coaching days, you know, I would have to have more empathy. I would have to understand or try to understand what the athletes are going to. And then how can I as a coach or us as a coaching staff adjust what we're doing as a program, you know, to accommodate it. And I know a lot of people would argue with that. But the thing is that the most important asset that a team has is its athletes, right? They're the ones who perform. They're right. The ones who score the goals or shoot the baskets or do whatever it is. And, you know, in order for them to perform at their peak level, you have to find out not only what best motivates them, but also what best, what the best structure is, you know, how, you know, to get them in their best situation so they can always perform at their highest levels. So, and again, Bob, I'm sorry that I cut you off earlier, but I think it's really important to bring out and to, you know, further reflect on Janine's point.
No, you two are an amazing conversation. I was going to say our friend Carl Olson, who is a former head of performance psychology at West Point and then at Penn State. And at West Point, it was getting people back on the front lines. It wasn't just getting football players back on the field after an injury. It was getting people back on the front lines after something went awry in a life or death situation. But often talks about non-judgment, the idea of being non-judgmental. And in my role as athletic integrity officer, I often use that the way we have to approach complaints or concerns being voiced are often through the yoga concept, although it's probably a legal word, equanimity. The idea that we accept that they're being made. We don't have to believe that they're entirely true, but we have a duty to figure out why they're being made and why they're being said and what the gravity of it is. So the idea of refraining from reaction, refraining from judgment, I think is really important in navigating this space. And it's advice that coaches find hard to accept, no?
100%, because coaches are used to, you know, kind of giving direction. There's a right and wrong way to box out. There's a right and wrong way to, you know, throw a javelin. And so, but this, I think it's not really clear what's right, what's wrong, what's good, so to take that non-judgmental stance, it's really hard. It's really hard. But I think that would benefit coaches. I really do. And maybe at the end of the day, make coaches' lives less stressful too, to just.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. Can I go back and go back to one thing Bob said,
please.
Or Bob asked earlier? This is like a real circle here. But when you asked about female athletes, you know, in college today, and I really wanted to talk about two pieces of that. And I can't, one is I kind of mentioned with the exposure and who gets lifted up, but I do worry about, we already have body image and eating disorders being rampant among athletes, right? And female athletes, like a lot. And then, you know, when you have a lot of exposure, a lot of visibility, a lot of being, you know, promoted, I just wonder about that. I wonder how that will amp up issues around body image and how someone looks versus who someone is, right? That isn't as readily apparent sometimes on various social media channels. And then the other piece female athlete, you know, women in general, as we know, with gender role socialization, women are socialized to be relational, to be in relationship, to maintain relationships, to put relationship above self in a lot of times, right? And so I think with women athletes now, you know, I'm always so struck by this, is that what often matters most to female athletes is, how am I getting along with my coach? How is the vibe with my teammates? You know, versus how am I performing in my sport, right? Performance isn't always number one in their mind. And if they feel like, if I can get these relationships on track, then I'll perform better. And I just think we also need to keep that in mind, whatever our role is in college sports, that relationships lead the way for female athletes.
So true.
Yeah.
Janine, before we start closing up this discussion, I did want to go back to something you brought up at the beginning about trauma-informed yoga. And I know there's lots of different names for it, but can you just talk for a few seconds about what trauma-informed yoga is? Why it's important, why it can be beneficial for athletes, or coaches, or really anyone, even if they feel that they don't have trauma.
Oh my gosh. Well, I think as a society in okay, so the tenets of trauma-informed yoga, for those of you who may not know, right? The main tenets are cultivating a sense of mindfulness and of present moment awareness, of grounding, and of having an awareness of being in our bodies. And if you take ourselves in modern times, right, modern culture right now, we move really fast. We're kind of relentlessly multitasking, right? Relentlessly multitasking, moving quickly. And I dare say we're a little dissociated from our bodies. We're not tuned in. So when we can have practices that kind of counteract this cultural norm, right? This isn't even adding trauma to the picture. This is just like cultural norm of stress and live being alive today, right? These practices that kind of are remedies for these chronic ways we disengage from present moment, I think can reset us neurobiologically, can reset us emotionally to where we have more capacities to relate and to sleep and to eat when we're hungry, like just these basic things. So I have found it a very powerful tool, not only as part of trauma treatment, but just to cope with today's world.
Janine, before we close our discussion today, for one, Bob and I really want to thank you so much. You've been incredible. We had you on the Annual Leadership Summit. Now we have you here on the Culture and Sports podcast. There's so many things with culture and sports we would love to have you on, and I'm sure we'll engage with you on that. But we normally at the Culture and Sports podcast, have the guests say the last word. So
Ooh.
with that, I ask you this, is if there's anything you could say to an athlete, a coach, support staff, an athletic department, a chancellor of a school or a president of a school, or family members, that form that ecosystem of support for the athlete, is there anything that you'd want to say to them? And it could be about any topic that you'd like.
Oh boy. Okay. Well, I would say that this, we are in a time of change, right? College athletics, I think we can agree to that. So to remember that maybe in times of change, it's important to maybe acknowledge and grieve maybe what was. Like, it's okay to be nostalgic or to be, you know, to yearn for maybe what was. And to also not what I call, not future trip into like worst case scenarios and catastrophic thinking about what's to come, because we don't know. So as much as possible to access, supports, the wisdom of how we've navigated change in the past, to stay present, to be transparent, to educate ourselves in the here and now. So not going back, I mean, maybe going back here, grieving, resisting the urge to catastrophize or future trip, and being present with what is as we navigate the unknown today. And that's what I would say.
And that's a wrap for this week's episode of the Culture and Sports Podcast. We hope that this episode has started an internal dialogue, or even one with your team, about the importance of leadership and organizational culture. If you'd like to learn more about culture and sports, the Culture and Sports Podcast, or other programs, go to cultureandsports.com, where there is a wealth of resources, articles, research, podcasts, video shows, webinars, and courses. And don't forget to connect with us on social media, on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, and LinkedIn at Culture and Sports, and on Twitter at Culture in Sport. Thank you for tuning in to the Culture and Sports Podcast.